Attention, attention. This is History Lost in Time.
And welcome to episode 80 of the History Lost in Time podcast. This podcast is available in both German and English, with a presence on YouTube, Spotify, Podcast.de, Blue Sky, and Instagram. There's also a music-based partner project on YouTube called HLIT AI Music.
The topic of this episode.
Anyone familiar with the 1981 film The Final Countdown, starring Kirk Douglas, also knows the scenario well. Let's drop modern technology into an earlier war and win battles that were originally lost. Even though the film has a somewhat predictable and thin plot, it is highly entertaining to watch F-14 Tomcats thundering over the Pacific in December 1941. Naturally, the Japanese Zeros, portrayed in the movie by T-6 Texan trainers, stand no chance. Could the USS Nimitz and its air wing have prevented the attack on Pearl Harbor? Who knows? The film ends without providing an answer. Since then, the internet has been flooded with videos along the lines of an F-35 versus the Japanese fleet and so on. In my opinion, however, both the film and these videos fall short and misrepresent the scenarios because they focus solely on the superiority of future technology. As the saying goes, amateurs talk about technology while professionals talk about logistics. So I'm going to take the path of the pro-amateur and try to talk about both.
Political agenda and background.
None.
The sources that were used.
It is difficult to rely on books for a simulation game of this kind, so I'm using a general mix of sources. Books on Pearl Harbor, for example, Janusz Pikalkiewicz's World War II, and technology, for example, American Eagles, as well as online resources. For the technical assessments, I consulted the AI models Google Gemini, Microsoft Copilot, and Mistral. While I am aware, for instance, that you cannot simply put World War II era aviation fuel into a modern jet, I do not know what would theoretically be possible or how modern engines would react to a 1940s-style kerosene blend. I therefore consulted all three AIs and synthesized their responses. The scenario. We send a fully combat-ready fighter jet piloted by a skilled aviator into the airspace between Pearl Harbor and the Japanese fleet early on the morning of December 7th, 1941. We examine what this single fighter can achieve against the Japanese forces, how the Japanese react, and how this impacts their attack on Pearl Harbor. Next, we consider what happens if the aircraft lands at Hickam Air Force Base in Honolulu and survives the attack. Of particular interest here are the following questions. Can the US Army Air Force continue to operate the aircraft in any capacity? And if so, how and for how long? Can US industry supply the aircraft with fuel, spare parts, and ammunition? Can US research learn from the aircraft, and if so, what? And how might this influence the future? To explore this, we consider fighter jets from various eras working backward from the present day. First, we look at a 2026 F-35. Next is an FA-18 from the 1990s, followed by an F-4 Phantom from the 1970s. Then comes an F-104 Starfighter from the 1960s, and finally an F-86 Sabre from the 1950s. Let us first consider the Japanese strike force. For the attack, the Navy deployed 6 aircraft carriers and an escort comprising 2 battleships, 2 heavy cruisers, 1 light cruiser, 9 destroyers, 8 tankers, and a total of 28 submarines. A total of 353 aircraft attacked Pearl Harbor in 2 waves, sinking 4 battleships, 1 former battleship, and a tugboat. 4 additional battleships, 3 light cruisers, 3 destroyers, and 3 other vessels were damaged. 188 aircraft were destroyed and another 159 were damaged. US forces lost 2,008 sailors, 109 Marines and 218 soldiers. In total, there were 2,335 fatalities and 1,143 wounded across all branches of the US military, as well as 68 deaths and 35 injuries among the civilian population. The Japanese lost 4 midget submarines and 29 aircraft, with another 74 aircraft damaged. They suffered 129 fatalities. The Japanese used 3 types of aircraft for their attacks: the A6M0 fighter, the D3A dive bomber, and the B5N torpedo bomber. The Nakajima B-5N, known to the Allies as the Kate, was a single-engine torpedo bomber capable of a top speed of 378 km per hour. It carried a single 800 kg torpedo and was armed with 3 7.7mm machine guns. The Aichi D3A, known as the Val, was slightly faster at 430 km per hour, but was similarly armed with 3 7.7mm machine guns. It typically carried one 250 kg bomb under the fuselage and 2 60 kg bombs under the wings. The Mitsubishi A6M, the Zero, was the Japanese fighter aircraft of the Pacific War. It reached speeds of 533 km per hour and was armed with 2 7.7mm machine guns and 2 20mm cannons. It could also be equipped with light bombs. Let's pit our assortment of modern combat aircraft against this first wave, starting with the F-35. The Lightning II is a stealth aircraft, so it wouldn't show up on either American or Japanese radar, assuming such radar systems were even present and active. It reaches speeds of just under 2,000 km per hour, is armed with a 25mm cannon, and can carry a total of 4 internal and 6 external weapons. Consequently, it could be deployed for this mission with either air-to-air or anti-ship weaponry. Naturally, the greatest impact would come from using the F-35 to sink the Japanese fleet, though that wouldn't do much to help Pearl Harbor if the first wave was already airborne. Let's therefore arm the F-35 with 10 air-to-air missiles. Our options include the AIM-9X Sidewinder, AIM-120 MRAM, and AIM-132 SRAM. Each of these missiles is fully capable of destroying at least one Japanese aircraft without the target being able to defend itself. The pilots wouldn't even realize they were under attack. The other Japanese pilots in the formation would likely attribute the losses to technical malfunctions or the detonation of bombs and torpedo warheads. These 10 air-to-air missiles would thus destroy 10 Japanese attackers. Afterward, the F-35 could engage in close-range combat using its 25mm cannon. In this phase, it might destroy another 2, 3, or perhaps even 4 attackers without being hit itself. As it dives through the Japanese formations at speeds approaching 1,000 km per hour, the Japanese pilots would feel as though they were standing still in midair. Due to its limited onboard ammunition supply and high rate of fire, the F-35 cannot sustain continuous fire for even 4 seconds. Consequently, it would be left unarmed after a maximum of 14 kills. It might still be able to weave through the Japanese ranks and rattle them, but the risk of a stray machine gun hit or a collision would increase, meaning a sensible pilot would hardly continue doing so for long. The Japanese would thus have lost 14 of their 353 aircraft. The vanguard of the first wave would be nervous and uncoordinated, which would sap the momentum of the attack. Would the Japanese turn back in a panic? Absolutely not. 3 years later, these same pilots would climb into inferior aircraft and dive, without hesitation, at American ships as kamikaze pilots. Their comrades on the ground almost never surrendered and frequently launched suicidal attacks with no hope of success. For these soldiers, samurai tradition and the Bushido code were of paramount importance. One cannot expect an adversary of this caliber to be deterred from its objective by unexpected events or losses. In this F-35 scenario then, Japanese losses are higher and their initial wave of attack is somewhat weaker. Consequently, it might be possible to save one additional American battleship. The second Japanese wave might attack with greater caution, but would likely achieve similar results. Has history been altered as a result? Only superficially, not decisively. Pearl Harbor remains a major traumatic defeat for the USA. What happens at Hickam now that the F-35 has landed? The F-35 is out of fuel and ammunition. Setting aside all the drama, we don't know who you are, we don't trust you, and we don't believe your story, the US Army Air Force reaches the following conclusions after analyzing the F-35. 1. They cannot refuel it. The F-35 runs on JP-8 or F-34 jet fuel. However, Hickam has no jet fuel, only high-octane aviation gasoline. If that were put into the F-35, the engine would likely fail almost immediately. 2. They cannot maintain the F-35. The F-35 is essentially a massive piece of electronics and software. Its electronics go far beyond anything understood in 1941. Anyone seeing circuit boards and chips instead of vacuum tubes would be completely out of their depth. Furthermore, the very concept of software is virtually unknown. If the F-35 refuses to start its engine due to a maintenance issue, and no one has a 2026 era diagnostic tool, the aircraft remains grounded, nothing more than a giant paperweight. 3. They cannot arm the F-35. Bombs and missiles are fired via electronic signals, not mechanical means. Even the 25mm onboard ammunition is fired electronically. Moreover, the US inventory in 1941 does not include any 25mm cannons. In short, the US military can do absolutely nothing with the F-35. It would have to be shipped to the US mainland for analysis. What could be done or learned there? Kerosene itself and jet engines are nothing new. At that time, the USA was on the verge of operating its first indigenous jet, the P-59, while the British already had a jet in the form of the Gloster E-2839. Consequently, it would likely be possible to synthesize a low-grade kerosene fuel quite quickly, one that could keep the F-35 flying at least at half power for a time. However, the engine's service life would almost certainly be drastically reduced. Another factor involves the necessary lubricants and oils. Oils used for piston engines in 1941 cannot simply be used in 21st century turbines. While the principle that any oil is better than none applies here too, the lack of suitable oils and lubricants would further drastically curtail the aircraft's lifespan. In principle, skilled technicians could install custom mechanical devices and release mechanisms to enable the aircraft to carry and drop bombs. Standard American bombs, for example 500 pounders, should pose no problem. Ammunition for the onboard cannon would be an issue. US technicians would either have to develop a firing mechanism compatible with the cannon's specific voltage requirements, or remove the cannon entirely and replace it with a US Army Air Force 20mm cannon or a 12.7mm machine gun. The main problem, however, would be contending with the onboard electronics. If the software were to fail due to errors or malfunctions and prevent the engines from starting, the aircraft would be grounded for good. So in the US, one could make the F-35 reasonably flight and combat capable, but only for a very short time and in a very limited capacity. The risk of losing the F-35 would be so high that no one would order missions. Instead, it would be treated as a subject for research. And what could be learned? I will discuss this in conjunction with the F-18, as there is a surprising amount of overlap between the two. Let us wrap up the F-35 scenario there and send a 1990s era F-18 into battle instead. If my information is correct, an F-18 can carry 9 weapon systems and is equipped with a 20mm cannon holding significantly more ammunition than that of the F-35. Using missiles, it could shoot down 9 Japanese aircraft and then take out another 5 with its onboard cannon, resulting in a total of 14 kills. In terms of aerial combat, it would thus achieve a level of success similar to the F-35. Consequently, the attack on Pearl Harbor would play out in much the same way. A success for the Japanese and a trauma for the USA, though perhaps with slightly lower American losses. On the ground, technicians at Hickam would find the F-18 somewhat easier to work with, even so they could not simply refuel the aircraft. However, they could mount their own 500-pound bombs onto the F-18's pylons and utilize the aircraft's internal release mechanisms via the emergency jettison mode. While 20mm ammunition was indeed being produced in 1941, it would not fit directly into the F-18's cannon. Nevertheless, manufacturing compatible ammunition would be possible without major difficulty. Electronics, however, would still pose a problem. Although the F-18 is not as technologically complex as the F-35, it too would remain grounded without the appropriate maintenance equipment. Hickam would therefore send the F-18 back to the USA for analysis, just as they would the F-35. The F-18's engine would handle the 1941 fuel mixture far better than the F-35's engine. While performance would still be significantly reduced, the engine's service life would not suffer such a drastic decline. However, the F-18 would face the same issues regarding lubricants and oils as the F-35. What could be learned from the F-35 or F-18? One would gain insights into aerodynamics and metallurgy. However, the electronics and onboard computers would be far beyond the capabilities of 1941 technology. Replicating the aircraft would be utterly impossible, and it would take decades before anyone could fully understand the F-35 or F-18. Beyond aerodynamics, the greatest benefit would be the realization that electronics and jet technology represent the future, while other nations, such as Great Britain with the Meteor and Germany with the ME-262, proceeded with cautious skepticism, the US could confidently push ahead with its own jet programs, knowing for a fact that this was the future rather than a technological dead end. Furthermore, the F-35 would provide knowledge regarding stealth concepts and carbon fiber composites, potentially accelerating the advent of these technologies by decades. Let us now turn to the F-4 Phantom scenario. Like the F-18, the F-4E has 9 weapon pylons. It could therefore shoot down 9 Japanese aircraft using a mix of AIM-9 Sidewinders and AIM-7 Sparrows. It could then use its onboard cannon to shoot down another 5 Japanese aircraft, likewise achieving a total of 14 kills. The attack on Pearl Harbor would thus unfold in exactly the same way as in the F-35 and F-18 scenarios. The F-4 is far more analog and mechanical in nature than the F-18, meaning Hickam Air Force Base would be better equipped to handle it. While the correct fuel is lacking here as well, technicians would readily understand the F-4's hydraulics, onboard cannon and weapon release systems. The same considerations regarding armament apply as with the F-18. In the US, it would soon be discovered that the F-4's J-79 engine runs surprisingly well on 1941-era jet fuel, albeit with reduced performance. The issue of oils and lubricants would not be quite as critical as with the F-35, though it would still persist. Eventually, it would become impossible to keep the F-4's electronics operational. But this is an aircraft capable of flying and fighting even without electronics. The F-4 would thus remain surprisingly combat capable and could be kept on standby for special missions, where a single aircraft might make the difference. As for reverse engineering, I will group the F-4 together with the F-104. Let us therefore move straight to the F-104. The Starfighter can carry a maximum of 7 weapons and could shoot down 7 Japanese aircraft using 7 Sidewinders. Afterward, boom and zoom attacks using the 20mm cannon would be possible. Just like the F-35, F-18 and F-4, the F-104 is supersonic and would leave the Japanese aircraft standing still in the air. However, its maneuverability is very limited. Consequently, rather than dogfighting and turning with the Japanese planes, it would thunder through their formation like a missile. Yet after 12 kills, it would be out of ammunition and forced to return to Hawaii. The Japanese attack would unfold in a manner similar to the previous scenarios. Compared to the F-4, the F-104 is even less reliant on electronics and operates more mechanically. It is not a true multi-role aircraft, however, but a dedicated interceptor. Its speed would be impressive. At Hickam, it could be fitted with bombs but not refueled. The same considerations regarding the onboard cannon apply here as they do for the F-18 and F-4. Back in the US, a usable kerosene blend could be produced, just as for the F-4, since the F-104 utilizes an older variant of the same J-79 engine. However, the F-104 would require very long runways for takeoff. The issue of oils and lubricants would be roughly the same as with the F-4 Phantom. So let us turn to reverse engineering. The F-104 and F-4 are supersonic fighters and therefore incorporate significant amounts of titanium. Initially, the US industry would be overwhelmed by the task of producing such large quantities of titanium. On the other hand, this would not be immediately necessary, as the industry would be unable to instantly replicate the J-79 engine and its specific fuel, a process that would take several years. In the medium term, however, the titanium industry would need to undergo a major expansion. Furthermore, the radar systems of both aircraft would pose a challenge for technicians. Even if the underlying principles were understood, the complexity and level of miniaturization would far exceed anything within their experience. In summary, both the engine and the onboard electronics would lie right at the edge of what was theoretically understood in 1941, yet replicating this technology would take many years. However, it would be possible to develop simplified versions within a shorter time frame. Additionally, valuable aerodynamic data would be gained, providing a clear direction for future development. Let us conclude with the F-86. It is the oldest aircraft on this list, yet also the one most compatible with the 1941 timeframe. It is the only one incapable of supersonic flight and lacking air-to-air missiles, although later versions did eventually carry the first AIM-9 Sidewinders. Originally, however, it was armed with 6 12.7mm machine guns or later 6 20mm cannons. It relies on no onboard computers and utilizes a simple, robust J-47 engine. The Sabre would be the only aircraft in our scenario unable to fire standoff weapons. It would also be the most vulnerable, as it must close the distance to the Japanese forces to shoot them down. While its flight performance is vastly superior to that of the A6M0s, the Japanese are not as hopelessly outclassed as they would be against supersonic jets. The Sabre could employ boom and zoom tactics to engage the Japanese, likely shooting down 5 to 10 of them, though it would also risk taking hits itself. Nevertheless, there is a high probability it would return to Hawaii unscathed. The Japanese attack would be disrupted but would still proceed, leading to the outcome already discussed on several occasions. It wouldn't be possible to refuel the Sabre at Hickam either. However, almost everything else could be handled there, supplying ammunition for the onboard guns, potentially loading bombs or unguided rockets, and carrying out basic repairs. In the US, a fully compatible fuel could be developed in very short order. The issue of oil and lubricants would be far less significant than with other aircraft models. While wear and tear and maintenance requirements would be higher, continuous operation would be feasible. Furthermore, US technicians would quickly grasp the mechanics of this aircraft, which has its roots in the late 1940s, and would likely be able to replicate it within 12 to 18 months. Consequently, F-86 Sabres would enter service with the US Air Force as early as 1943. This would dramatically shift the air war in favor of US forces. The US would leap nearly a decade ahead in aerodynamics and jet technology almost overnight, though the aerodynamics themselves would still need to be fully understood in theoretical terms. Engine technology components, such as heat-resistant turbine blades, could present challenges.
A few finishing words.
Let's summarize. 1. In direct area combat, all these aircraft would be vastly superior to the Japanese planes. The F-86 alone would face higher risk due to its lack of standoff weapons, yet it could succeed using boom and zoom tactics and high-speed attacks with moderate risk. However, a single aircraft would not alter the outcome of the attack on Pearl Harbor. 2. The more modern the aircraft, the less the technicians at Hickam would be able to do with it. 3. Interestingly, the analysis reveals an inverse relationship between immediate utility and long-term utility. The F-86 would offer the highest immediate utility, though its long-term value would run out by the 1950s. Conversely, the F-35 would provide almost zero immediate utility, yet its long-term impact would be felt for decades. While replicating the components exactly would be impossible, simplified versions could be manufactured and perfected over the course of decades. 4. The US could learn from all these aircraft. The greatest impact would be knowing, in an instant, the direction in which military aviation was evolving and what systems would need to look like in the decades to follow. They could bypass technological dead ends and work toward specific goals instead. The US would remain decades ahead of other nations beyond their reach. Let me know how you think of this format and whether I should do it again sometime. Feel free to suggest scenarios.
Thank you. This was History Lost in Time.